The following podcast is a Dear Media production.
This is Amanda Hirsch from the Not Skinny But Not Fat podcast. You might know me from Not Skinny But Not Fat on Instagram, where I spend my time talking about reality TV, celebrities, everything happening, and pop culture every Tuesday, okay? I also talk to some of our favorite celebs and reality TV stars. We talk about what's going on. Tune in every Tuesday and just feel like you're talking with your best friends in your living room.
Yo, 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 and welcome back to Creeps and Crimes
Podcast.
I'm Taylor.
I'm Morgan. Happy Thursday and happy episode 149.
149.
I feel like a new bitch. Should we tell them why?
Yeah.
I got a Mac. Big MacBook desktop.
She did.
Which means my notes are going to be fucking flame fuego today.
She texted me this morning and was like, I was on the Mac until 11 o'clock last night. And I was like, when she got it, she FaceTimed me from it. And I was like, let the obsession begin.
No, let it start. And it immediately kickstarted.
Because it is addicting. You cannot.
It's just so aesthetic.
It is aesthetic as fuck. And then it just kind of becomes your whole world all in one location. Yep. Because you can do everything and it doesn't ever like die.
Yeah. And my desk gets here Saturday, so you can come over after my big poop party and you can build it.
Okay.
You're like, fuck no.
No, I love building. You know,
and
I love
building. And then I got,
you
know, those wide leg chairs that you can like sit well.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
A non-large tip person could probably sit crisscross on it. I'm a hope I'm
no the ones that they sell that are made to
they're
be
like
able to
literally
pull your
legs like
up.
This big.
Yeah.
Yeah. I got one of those.
Dude, I wanted to get one of those when I got this. But then this one was wide enough, allegedly.
Mm-hmm.
I can. It's not comfy.
Right. But you're on it all day long.
I'm on it all day long.
I think this will suffice until I do make the switch to be on it all day long. Then I'll probably have to get something a little more supportive. But I think this will do for, you know, the couple
for the time
hours
being.
I'll be on it.
Well, and that's just like so comfy. The only thing that comes down with
can't
those types of chairs is like our old recording chairs.
Yeah.
Raise your hand if you've been personally victimized by the green and yellow chairs. I want everyone that's listening to this fucking podcast to raise their hand.
Because you have been.
You have been.
The way the yellow chair literally had metal rods sticking into your ass and back.
Literally, I would stand up, guys, from recording, and there would be a 2x4 mark on my ass. That's how uncomfortable
the green
was.
Chair lasted longer than the yellow.
Well, because I used to sit in the yellow one. This is where I'm coming back in because it was so wide on the bottom that I could sit crisscross in it comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
Guys, I was at the chiropractor every fucking day.
Yeah.
Every single day I was over there and he basically was like, what are you doing? Like, are you just getting in car accidents after car accident?
Right. Well, I would like us to really work on our posture. I think that's going to be our 2024 goal.
I think so too.
Because I need it. Like, when I've gotten my ass kicked at work this week and last week, but my neck area and back, like, I just have to lay on the floor when I get home and like hope that it helps because I really burnt the bridges with my chiropractor here in Knoxville.
Yeah.
But they did that to me. They didn't tell me that at the start of the new year, I'm just a young adult, right? I don't know insurance and deductibles and shit. They didn't tell me that at the start of the new year, your deductible is met, which means your chiropractic visit is not covered, which means you need to pay $585 today. And I'm like,
hell no. I get a text message. I get a text message at the beginning of end and beginning of every single year from my chiropractor because he's got my number. Like, I love him. And he'll be like, hey, I need $148 or whatever the fuck it is. And this year it's going to be so high because this is the first year that we haven't gone consistently.
Chiropractic visits need to be more covered through health insurance.
Yeah. 100%. I think most things do.
Well, me too. But they like view like chiropractic as like
cosmetic.
Some insurances, they don't even like consider it a special visit, which is like.
How like insulting to the chiropractic world.
I know. I think their shit's important.
Justice for the chiropractors.
No, justice for the chiropractors.
They need to get in a union and go on strike.
Mm-hmm. But I will say mine was like, you got this going on, this going on. Yep, it's going to be about 7 years for us to get you fixed. I'm like, oh, that's a lot of money and a lot of time. Mm-mm. I mean, I was going, twice a week?
Yeah.
No, I was going once a week.
But so I stopped going because it just was making me tighter.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept stretching and doing all that stuff. And I haven't needed to go. I've had back
pain. I need to
start
stretching again because I did that for like 2 months straight. Like every night I would stretch and I just felt so much better. That's what I need to do.
Yeah. Well, I just stretch. Stretching's important. I stretch when I'm putting on my moisturizer on my face and my lotion and everything. I'll just sit there and stretch in front of the bed.
Yeah. If I'm playing with Ollie and I'm on the ground, like I end up like doing like a
Or if I'm watching straddle. TV in the living room.
Yeah.
It'll start with me sitting on the couch.
And you're like,
for some reason, I'll be like, let me put my leg behind my head. Do you think I can still do this?
I do.
Can I do a bow and arrow still? And I'll just start, let me try a fucking scorpion while we're here. And
I'll stretch.
I'll literally pull all these motherfucking things and I'll be like, oh, I need to stretch. So then I'll get down on the floor and I'll stretch for like 2 hours while we're watching TV.
You remember the video of us pulling heel stretches on the day bed? That was so long ago.
That was so long ago.
That was cute.
What were we doing? Was that a shot fired?
I don't know what it was. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was. We were drunk.
That was crazy.
So should we build some hype up for episode 150?
Okay.
Let's give them 3 hints.
So last week we said to them, there's nothing fun planned. So don't get excited for it.
Yeah.
No. We lied.
By the literal seat of our pants. Is that the saying?
What are you saying?
By the seat of our pants. Last minute, hardly. Is that not the right?
Seat of my pants. It's like, I'm just kind of winging it.
Oh, that's not what the right saying.
I mean, so, but honestly, God, by the grace of God.
By the grace of God is the right saying.
Okay, here. So that, or not that night, the following night, we were recording and we both had been texting back and forth and we're like, we've got to do something.
Right.
Like, for 150.
Huge. That's 150 episodes.
It's a big deal. And it's like technically our 195th fucking episode.
That's nuts.
And our episode, our 45th regular bonus Patreon goes out on August 1st.
Oh my God.
And then on top of that, I calculated with Logan in the car how many episodes we've recorded on Patreon with bonus episodes, everything. It's like 225, something like that.
That just can't be real.
226, something crazy.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
I wonder how many days that is. So we were like, we need to do something.
Yeah, we got to do something.
We were like, oh, they really like the dark histories. But then we were like, we just did that.
Yeah.
And then we were like, oh, well, we would love to do Reddit again. But then Reddit's like, anyone that uses our shit, sued. So we were like, what do we do? What do we do? And so we have put together something that I think everyone is going to be really fucking excited about.
I literally
We don't
can't.
Know how it happened.
No. It was on a whim. On a whim.
You know what
That's
it was?
What you meant to say.
It
on a whim.
On a whim. It was Venus. Venus did this for us.
I fucking love Venus.
I love you, Venus.
She's such a queen.
So let's give them 3 hints.
Okay. Number one, drinks are going to be involved.
Drinks are going to be involved.
Number two,
Nashville.
And then third hint, this is something that October 2020, Morgan and Taylor
would shit their pants.
Would literally fall the fuck out.
Yeah.
Would fall the fuck out.
So.
Yeah. And I know a lot of you guys are going to be like, I think I know what it is. You're wrong.
Yeah, you're wrong.
Just know that you're wrong.
I don't want to say this, but let's say that maybe we teased it like years ago.
We literally teased it years ago.
So do with that what you may.
Mm-hmm.
I think only the real people that like really know Taylor are like
OGs.
Obsessed. I think you guys will figure it out.
Yeah. I think the people that are like the OG pick-me's, the OG besties.
They'll know.
They'll know.
So, on that note,
let's hit them with it.
We'll see you next week on 150. If you're driving, throw that shit on cruise control.
If you got a glass, pour that shit up.
And let's get creepy.
Okay, Morgan, what do you have for us today?
Okay, today I'm going to be talking about the Kamar Daban incident.
Okay.
Or some people refer to it as the Forgotten Dyatlov Pass.
Oh my God, I've never heard of this.
The Dyatlov Pass incident is considered to be one of the greatest mysteries of all times. Over 60 years later, and there still is not an agreed upon conclusion as to what happened in the mountains to those hikers. If you have no idea what mystery I'm referring to, I covered the story of Dyatlov's Pass in season 1, episode 26. So listen with caution.
Oh, God.
Definitely one that we could revisit and
probably should
in the future.
I literally, but I feel like, okay, 20, that would have been 20 weeks in. We knew how to do research and we got our mics before then.
Right. I guess the number 2-6 looks so low, but we probably were a little more established at that point.
And I remember that episode being so good.
Yeah.
Okay. God knows what I covered.
Yeah. I don't know. Anyway.
Episode 26.
Episode 26.
Holy shit.
So nonetheless, it was a mystery, leaving 9 hikers dead in the Northern Ural Mountains in 1959. There was unexpected weather conditions during their trip, and when it was time to return, the hikers never made it back. Search party took off, and they came across the group dead with a variety of causes. Hypothermia, internal bleeding, head trauma, chest trauma. The camp was in pieces and the tents were cut open from the inside. The hikers were all found in different areas, most naked with only socks on. Some groups in the same area reported seeing orange spheres in the sky the night the group died. But the logical explanation that everyone came to was that there was an avalanche, and no one to this day agrees on what had happened during that trip. But the biggest part that draws people into the Dyatlov Pass mystery is its uniqueness. It was an incident that many believed could never happen again.
Mm-hmm.
Until it did. On August 9th, 1993, there was a group of Ukrainian kayakers who were paddling their way through this relatively remote river in southern Siberia. And this river would eventually take them to the Kamar Daban mountain range, and they would get like a full view of its entire beauty, like the entire range you'd be able to see. But as they went up the river, one kayaker had noticed something moving kind of slowly through the woods. It was a woman who seemed to be wandering aimlessly. She was all alone. There was blood all over her jacket. So the kayakers were calling out, asking, "Do you need any help? What's your name? Are you okay?" They were concerned, as anybody would be if they saw this, but she didn't answer. She didn't say a single word, because whatever she saw on that mountain range had traumatized her. She was in a state of shock, a state so serious that she wouldn't speak on the incident for years following.
Holy shit.
The kayakers rushed to the shore, knowing that whatever happened to her was serious. They took her back to the nearby town to receive medical treatment, and this is when authorities learned her name, Valentina Yodachenko. Valentina was a part of a tourist expedition through the mountain range, and when she started the expedition, she wasn't alone. When she started her hike, she was with 6 others. It was August 2nd, 1993, just 7 days before Valentina was found on the shore of the river. 7 Russian hikers set off on a trip into the Kamar Daban mountain range. The mountain range is located in Buryatia, which is now a part of the Republic of Russia, but was once southern Siberia, Russia. I'm not sure about all that or what that means. I don't know. All I know is that it is cold as fuck. Winter months average anywhere from -6 degrees Fahrenheit to 17 degrees Fahrenheit. And the summer months average highest 64 degrees, but they'll usually say around 35 to 45.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So 64 is like sunny and 75.
Right. Sunny and 85 to
I could never live anywhere like that.
Right. Leader of the expedition was 41-year-old Ludomia Korvina. And following behind her was 23-year-old Alexander Kreisen, 24-year-old Tatiana Filipenko, 19-year-old Denis Vachkin, 16-year-old Victoria Zalasova, 15-year-old Tamar Bapanov, and 17-year-old Valentina Yodachenko. While most of these hikers were young, some even teenagers, they were all at this time pretty experienced with the outdoors and hiking. This was not their first rodeo. This was not like a beginner's hike. This was advanced.
Right.
And their leader, Ludomia, was an internationally renowned like master of in tourism with tons and tons of knowledge of the area that she would be taking this group hiking in.
I mean, yeah, of course you have to be to hike something right. like that.
The group was well prepared, and the mountain range at this time was not really dangerous. It was the middle of summer because August is like their warmer month, and the Kamar Daban mountain range brought in loads and loads of tourists at this time. The forecast was predicting clear skies. It was nearly perfect conditions to reach their final destination on the mountain range, which was Ludianka. But when Ludomia's group set out on the morning of August 2nd, so did 2 other groups. These 2 groups would be following alongside the main group on nearby trails. And one of these groups was led by Ludomia's 16-year-old daughter, Natalia. The plan was that each group would take different routes, and they would meet up the next day in the mountains before the advanced group, aka Ludomia's group, would then continue their expedition to their final destination, Ludianka. Majority of that first day, the weather was clear, and the forecast prediction was accurate. until it wasn't. And this is where a lot of people find similarities between Dyatlov's Pass and Kamar Daban. In both incidents, the weather took a turn for the worse. But in this incident, which was supposed to be filled with clear blue skies and 64 degrees, did a 360 and on and off freezing rain poured down from the skies.
Holy shit.
And this couldn't have come at a more inconvenient time in the group's trek up the mountain. They were climbing the Kanulu Mountain, which was steep. And from this weather, they knew what would be coming next, a snowstorm.
Oh, shit.
By August 4th, which would be meetup day, the snowstorm was in full effect, and it wrecked the Kanulu trails and forced them to reroute, which ultimately leads to them missing their connection to the meetup spots with the other groups.
Okay.
So Ludamia makes a decision that, you know, we need to head to the nearest clearing and set up camp for the night, which would be almost at the top of the summit of this mountain.
Okay.
So she's like, the weather's shit, but we need to keep going, find a clearing, set up camp, and get some sleep. And right. Try to wait it out.
Well, and you can't see anything in something like that. So right. What's the point of just walking in circles? It's more dangerous.
Exactly. While this seems like the most logical choice, this decision doesn't really sit well with a lot of people that know this story. Because there was a known popular human-built shelter that was on top of that exact mountain they were on. And it was only about 30 minutes tops of a trip from where the hikers had initially set up camp. From the clearing.
I mean, everyone can say that.
Right. And that's what I have here. I said, we don't know the exact conditions. They were finding unexpected weather. Everyone was probably fucking exhausted.
Right.
So who's to suggest that she actually made the wrong decision?
You know?
Like, so I disagree with why people have beef with that. Like, I get looking at it on a map. Like, here's where they were. This is the clearing they picked. And this is the shelter that was built in place. Like,
right.
I see that from a mathematical point of view. Like, that would make sense.
And like, we don't hindsight.
Know. Right. We don't know what was going on at that time.
Right. And plus, like, going back to, we don't know what they were dealing with at the time. For all we know is maybe that's where she was originally trying to go.
Yeah.
And got turned around herself, or there were people in the group that couldn't handle it.
Right. Exactly. Regardless of the decision, it didn't matter because they made it through the night, and come morning time, they woke up to more shitty weather. Snow was still falling. It was stormy, windy, cold, and wet. Ludamia suggested the only thing that she knew to do at this point, descent from the summit and seek shelter in the covered woods below the mountain, which again, I'd do the same thing, especially if I was an exhausted and frightened teenager. Hell yeah, get me the fuck off this mountain. Like,
yeah.
I'm down to descend. Like, we don't need to make it to the summit. The weather's shitty. It didn't clear up. It's still going. Like, I'm ready to go.
I just need to go.
So the group starts to descend. And this is when 24-year-old Alexander, who was definitely viewed as the strongest and biggest of the group, collapsed to the ground, foaming at the mouth.
What?
And I'm just going to give a giant, like, trigger warning for gruesome details.
Okay.
Over the rest of the episode. So listen with caution. Alexander was seizing on the ground while blood was rushing out of his ears and nose. And in just minutes before this, he was in perfect health. But now he was dying right in front of this group. They were shook, stunned, speechless, attempting every measure they could to help him, but there was nothing they could do. Ludamia had instructed the rest of the group to keep moving, because at this point, the weather's dangerous, and she has one hiker down. Tells the group to keep moving, pointing the other two boys, Dennis and Tamar, in charge as she stayed behind with Alexander, attempting all she could to keep him alive.
Oh my God.
The five children, literally, they're teenagers.
Yeah.
The five teens continued in fear down the mountain and into the forest. But they were just kids. They no longer had their leader. They no longer had the strongest group member. They were terrified. And to make matters worse, heading down the mountain, all they could hear through the snowstorm was the wailing screams of pain from what they thought was their friend, Alexander. But as they listened, this was no man. This was a female screaming.
Oh my God.
The group turned around and rushed back up from where they came from to check on Ludamia. But what they found was Alexander dead. And their leader, Ludamia, dying right there next to him.
Shut up.
She was unable to move, exhibiting the same symptoms that Alexander had just did.
Oh my God.
This sparks chaos and mass paranoia from the group. Who was next? What the fuck was going on?
Right.
What is happening? But before they could put a thought together, two more hit the ground. Victoria and Tamar collapsed, twitching violently, blood leaking from their eyes and their ears.
No way.
Unlike Alexander, the two began ripping their clothes off, tearing at them, and grabbing onto their own necks as if they were fighting something that was choking them. So they weren't grabbing like this. They were grabbing like there was already hands on their
necks.
Oh,
my God.
Valentina rushed over to Victoria's aid before she was bitten by Victoria and backed off.
Bitten?
Like, get the fuck away from me. Bite.
Oh, my God.
Dennis abandoned ship, taking off away from the group. He was scared. He just watched his friends in the most chaotic and gruesome scene die one by one.
Yeah.
He ran down into the woods and hid. Back at the scene, Tatiana begins to rip her clothes off as well, grabbing at her own throat as if her own body was torturing her. She dropped down to the ground and crawled over to a rock, where she then began bashing her head into it over and over again. In just a couple moments, this group of seven dwindled down to two. And with Dennis running away, Valentina was the only one left standing there as her friends lied there, lifeless. Dennis then reemerges, and him and Valentina go down to the end of the woods closest to the site. They sat there. They didn't speak, unsure of what to do, scared and confused. But shortly after this, Dennis collapses as well and begins showing the same symptoms as everyone else, leaving only Valentina. She ran as far away as she could, sleeping in a tent that she had been carrying. But what she had on her person was not enough to survive in the wilderness alone. So she had to return back to the site to get more supplies.
Oh my God.
She then wandered for the next 4 days in the woods. And 4 days later, she was found by the kayaking group and rescued. Police sent out rescue teams to the mountains, but with Valentina silent, scarred, and traumatized, they weren't sure where they needed to be looking. It took 3 weeks to locate the bodies of the remaining hikers. And when the rescue members finally found the hikers, they understood why Valentina was traumatically muted. One rescue person said, quote, "It was a scary picture. The hikers were lying on a small ledge, some huddled together, some a little distance away. They had no eyes. In the empty sockets and parted mouths, worms were crawling."
What?
No one could have ever imagined that it would look like this. Police wanted answers. What happened to those six hikers? The bodies were then flown to the Siberian city of Ilanudy, where autopsies were performed. The reports ruled that all but Ludmila had died of hypothermia. Ludmila's cause of death was ruled as a heart attack. They were all found to have bruised lungs, and they were all found to have a protein deficiency, pointing to the assumption that the group had not been eating enough. But many believe that's not what happened at all. Of course, to this day, the question remains unanswered, and it falls into the mystery category right behind Dyatlov's Pass. But there are tons of theories. Let's go through a few. But first things first, let's rule out hypothermia.
Yeah.
The hikers had only been outside the tent for just a couple minutes before Alexander was the first to collapse.
Mm-hmm.
They just had a well-rested, warm, full nights of sleep.
Yeah.
And leaving the tent, not one single one of them showed any signs of hypothermia. But hypothermia does point to the paradoxical undressing, which is what we saw in Dyatlov's Pass.
Yeah.
Why many believe they were found naked is because your brain switches to you that you're hot, hot, hot. And
right.
You need to cool off. But that's not really the case. And while, yes, it was a snowstorm, it was also summertime, and the temperatures low that weekend was barely below freezing. And the protein deficiency theory, Valentina put to rest. She said the group was well fed, and they even had a big breakfast the morning of the tragedy. So if it wasn't hypothermia and it wasn't protein deficiency, what was it?
Right.
I'm going to read through a couple of theories that I found on morbidcuriosity.com. But the biggest theory is that they were victims of Soviet nerve agents. Many researchers had pointed out over the years that the symptoms that Valentina reported that the group had before passing are compatible with dying from chemical weapons, particularly nerve agents. Convulsions and mouth foamings are symptoms of a powerful nerve toxin. The autopsy's findings and death are consistent with this. Lung bruising can be a marker of death by nerve gas, since exposure to nerve agents can cause respiratory difficulty. The second theory is that they stumbled upon something enigmatic. According to this, it's possible that the hikers maybe accidentally stumbled into a Russian military experiment in the mountain range and were killed as a result. The police and medical examiner would then lie about their deaths. And given that they had taken a different route than the usual through hiked area, it's probable that their altered route maybe brought them into contact with some sort of researchers or experimenters who weren't expecting visitors. Despite this, this explanation has two major flaws: the spot where the hikers died and Valentina's survival. In the summer, numerous tour groups can be seen passing through the Kamar Daban Mountains at any one moment. So it would be really odd for some top secret experiment to be happening in a public space during the tourist season in Siberia.
Right.
Especially when there are so many options for secrecy in those mountains. Like, they could win anywhere else. Not big fucking tourist attraction.
Right. You're not going to go 30 minutes away from where this fucking giant hut is that everyone keeps talking about.
Right. Also, the portion of the mountain where the hikers died was an open space that was visible from the air and higher land. So the Kamar Daban Mountains themselves would not really make sense as a location for a top secret operation because satellites can literally see that there's a research facility in the mountains. And I think any other country, specifically the United States, would be like,
see that there?
This? What is doing that? Another theory is that Valentina was delusional. When someone experiences trauma, they often will remember details incorrectly, especially when they're recounting the event as much as Valentina did afterwards. So like, she was mute for a couple of years, but when she started, it was over and over and over again because a lot of people weren't believing her story. Some people go to the extreme and say that maybe she had a psychotic break and that she killed the group. But again, that doesn't explain the bruising in the lungs, the bleeding from the eyes and the mouth. Like, that's unless she poisoned them.
Right. The only other thing that I had a question about was when she was covered, when she was found, she was covered in blood.
Right. Well, and she was helping everyone and she got bit by one of her friends. So
you're right. So at first she was helping them before they realized it was something that was possibly transmissible.
Yeah. Another theory is rainwater contamination. So this assumes that poisons were brought down by the freezing rain. So they were picked up from wherever, some sort of chemical laboratory, and the hikers then consumed them whenever they were stranded, summiting up a mountain and freezing pouring rain.
Right.
A well-known location for the disposal of toxic waste is Lake Baikal, which is located just right above the mountains. It's like a huge, giant toxic waste dump.
Oh, wow.
So the hikers might have unintentionally ingested those lethal chemicals with their meal if the toxic waste had been like swept downstream and into the water.
Well, that's what I'm wondering. Why would we have a toxic fucking lake at the top of a mountain so it can run down?
Where tourists... The biggest Hi-cat. Tourist attraction is.
This is the biggest fucking oversight in the solar system.
And some can kind of combine the rainwater with the nerve agents and say that if a nerve agent was in the toxic waste and it got evaporated up into the air and that rained down, that would explain why maybe both of those theories together. Another theory is that they had eaten something poisonous out there, whether mushrooms or berries caused them to go psychotic and like hurt themselves, which is would explain the bashing of the head and acting like they were being choked. But I was sitting at work today and I was talking to Nicole about this and we came up with our own little theory that I want to talk to you about. So we know there's holes in the ozone layer.
Right.
Right. And specifically those holes lie up above the Arctic region. So the North Pole is where most of them. Well, Russia is like the North Pole on the other side of it. Mm-hmm. Not our North Pole, but the other side of it. So the symptoms of a drop in bariatric pressure. What's the word?
I know what you're talking about.
Pressure.
Yeah.
Air pressure is bleeding from the eyes and the ears.
Yeah, you're right.
And suffocating. And your lungs would be bruising. So she thinks that maybe where they had camped or where they were walking down, we don't know how ozone holes work. Like, I don't think it's like just like a stream of like boom, but like maybe something did shift in the air pressure and it caused them to suffocate themselves.
Yeah.
Through that?
Yeah. I mean,
but then we found another theory.
Okay.
Because we were a little bored at work today. If you work with me and you're listening to this, no.
No, you don't.
You actually don't work with me. And this is, I think it was called methane time bombs.
Okay.
And so they're deposited all over Russia's ground. And methane poisoning is almost the same as a chemical nerve agent. So it's not like a deposit as like they're placing time bombs down there. It's a natural gas that sits in the mountains and can be released at any minute. Like like how we have natural gas under us right now that we use or oil and stuff like that. This is methane. And it's most commonly up in the North Arctic region where that's found. So methane poisoning also is the same symptoms as, not exact same, but relatively the same symptoms.
Well,
but
yeah.
None of it explains why Valentina would survive all that. And then, of course, you have your supernatural theories with they came across something in the fucking mountains that was not visible, which is why they felt like they were being choked. And I saw this comment on this YouTube video. So I'll link the YouTube video below. But the comment was that this girl. She was like, my dad was in the military, da da da, and he always told me that you should never be out in the woods without a flashlight, without protection, and it was one other thing. I have to fucking read it now.
Find it.
Because it was like, I was like, holy shit. Like, where are my Google Docs at, though?
I'm really confused.
Well, no one knows. And no one talks about this because it's overlooked because of Dyatlov's pass.
Yeah.
Like, it gets the most attention.
So wait, I'm trying to remember. I'm trying to like rack my brain. I know they were found with like only their socks on, like stripped down. But was there any other symptoms? Like, was there blood or anything like that with Dyatlov's pass?
They had like crushed pieces of, I think their skulls were crushed. Like, they had like serious,
like, pressure. Cause like, all I can think is for them to have the symptoms over here at this new case that we're talking about. What's the name of it again?
Kamar Dabon.
Okay. Is that a C and a D?
K and a D.
KD.
Kappa Delta.
Right. Their symptoms were pressure, like how you would see, like if someone went down and was.
And for them to not be found without eye sockets, where'd their eyes go?
Where the fuck did their eyes go?
It's like pressure from the inside popped them out.
Right. And so did they, like, I need to see, like, if in the autopsies, did they report that it looked like animals had gotten to them?
So with this case comes a lot of photos and videos, and the rescue team has videos, and the hikers themselves were taking film like the entire time, not like video film, but like camera film.
Yeah.
Like, they have pictures from their entire trip, not so much the scene itself, but like the rescue team, what I saw was blurred out, but like, yeah, you could see where the bodies were laying in the rocks.
Yeah.
It was pretty fucked
And then
up.
They were all together, but originally.
No. It said that some of them were lying together, which were, I would make assume, sense. Alexander and Ludmilla, because right. She was laying next to him.
Right.
And then another two collapsed probably at the same time. And I'm sure they're all standing around huddled together like, what the fuck is going on?
Right.
Okay, so this is what the comment says. Before my dad went to the Forest Army or NFA, he told me to never go into the woods without a gun for protection, a flashlight for obviously light, and a long book to keep yourself sane and to not kill your friends, and a mirror to tell if your friends and yourself are real or not.
Whew.
What
I got
the
chills
fuck?
All over my body.
What the fuck?
No, that's a thing.
Yeah. And it's also weird that the biggest guy went down first.
Right.
Their protection. And then the oldest went down second.
And the oldest was the literal guide.
Right. That's also weird.
The way that they were taken out one by one, too, is like so odd. Like, if right. they had all walked in an area and Valentina was at the front of the group and right. everybody else like dropped.
One by one.
But it was one
and again,
after another.
This story that we have is only from Valentina's recollections,
right.
which could be totally trauma blocked and she could be misremembering a lot of things. But like, this is her account. This is what she says happened.
I mean, she sat with it for 2 years or 3 years.
Right.
I'm sure there was therapy sessions going on with this is a huge thing, and you know they're probably yeah. like, well, I don't give a fuck about you being trauma blocked right now, we got to get down to the bottom of it,
right? Especially if she did see something that she shouldn't have.
Yeah,
like if there was some sort of
anything
military involvement at all, like they would want to know and get to the bottom of it. And she probably, that also eliminates that, because if that was the case, she probably wouldn't be alive.
No
would have found her,
definitely,
and they would have gotten her after the fact,
right? And then it can't be something that was passed from one person to another, because she went back and got some of their supplies.
Right.
So it would have been contaminated.
Right.
And that never happened.
But what I did find odd was that she said, we all ate breakfast together. So that's what makes me think that maybe something was contaminated and maybe she ate something different.
Well, yeah, that's what I was about to say. I wonder if they like asked her, like, was there a communal water source that you guys were getting water from, that you had enough water right. from the first day or whatever?
Yeah.
Because I have to imagine, how old was she again? She was young.
I think she was one of the younger ones, maybe like 18.
Yeah.
Pull it up.
I mean, that's just really.
No, like I want answers, but.
And it's still like unsolved.
17. She was 17 years old.
She was 17 years old. So you have to think, when we were 17, I'm sure she didn't drink all of her water.
Right. I'm fine.
Yeah. Like, I'm good right now. I mean, it's fucking freezing outside. You want me to drink water right now? I'm literally freezing.
And it just makes you think, like, you know how people say, like, there's something in the ocean that wants you out? Like, mm-hmm. maybe there's something in the mountains, too. And they are like, big fucking snowstorm. You're not supposed to be over here. Like, what are you doing here? You need to go.
Yeah.
And it's some sort of supernatural phenomena that I don't know why she lived.
The only other thing that I could think of is that the pressure changed with that storm that rolled in. Like, if we were going to be like really, really reasonable and take out any other crazy loopy shit that we want to talk about, I would say that this big storm came in. It fucked with the pressure. Maybe some ozone drama going on.
Maybe a methane time bomb.
Who knows? They're sleeping and it affects everyone differently. When they started walking,
they started walking down, started descending.
So then their pressure is changing and it affected the older people first before affecting maybe people that were smokers or something, since it has so much to do with the lungs and the way that blood travels through your upper half.
Fucking Jesus. Crazy.
I mean, how are they just letting Diatlov's pass and Katie sit here and be unsolved?
Right.
These are really concerning fucking cases that nobody seems like they care to figure out.
Right.
Like, did you check the oxygen levels in their blood? Like, is there anything else we could do?
Right. And how, I mean, I guess like Ludamia's thing of like dying of a heart attack. I'm sure she did have a heart attack whenever she was convulsing on the ground. Like,
because she's freaking out.
She's freaking out. She had already seen the first one. You know what I mean?
She knew what was going to happen.
Maybe that was her cause of death. But yeah. That's not, we didn't run toxicity. We didn't.
No. I'm sure that it wasn't.
What did I say? 1997.
Yeah. I'm sure that she started experiencing the symptoms and had a heart attack, still continuing the symptoms and went down. But for her to have time to scream, like Alexander, he didn't. He just dropped, right?
Right. He dropped, collapsed.
He was
And everyone else was collapsing.
Right. Just boom.
But she was screaming.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, shit.
I know. I want to know. I wish I was there.
Like, not really to be a part of it, but like, I wish I could see what happened. Like, if there was like a fucking time machine that I could go hide in a fucking tree somewhere and see what happened.
I know. When there's mysteries like this, like, and there's so many possible explanations. I mean, we have rainwater, nerve toxin, pressure.
A toxic lake at the top.
Hypothermia. It's just, it doesn't make any sense to me that they would be hypothermic at all, because that doesn't explain the lungs bruising and it doesn't explain beating your head off a rock. And
it seems like it's like pressure in the head, like hurting your head. Like when Aaron was coming down and he couldn't get the pressure to pop.
Right. He was rocking.
You literally, like, you feel crazy. I was driving the other day and I couldn't get mine to pop and I was like freaking out trying to get it to pop.
Which would explain the eyes and the ears.
Yep. For the eye, like if the eyes exploded from
pressure. If you feel like you're suffocating, then yeah, your lungs are probably expanding and they're bruising from your ribcage. They're bruising off your ribcage.
And like if I couldn't breathe, I would still grab my chest and my neck.
Right.
Just like a human reaction to it.
I wonder why that is, the human reaction to grab it. When you can't breathe, to grab it.
I guess because this is a sign that's choking. And so we see it. It's like kind of conditioned.
But even kids do it, you know?
Well, because you think like, okay, where do I breathe from? My mouth. So I guess if I'm not breathing well, I'm being like, well, this is the only tube, you know? I guess it's just like process of elimination of where.
Why do we literally have one way to breathe as human beings?
Just one hole.
Literally.
One tube.
One tube.
One fucking tube.
That we also shove food down. Do we breathe through our esophagus? No, there's nothing else there.
Your esophagus, it goes like separates. So whenever you're chewing or you're swallowing or eating, it clogs the one that goes to your lungs.
But it's the same tube.
From your mouth and your nose, it's the same. That's why food can come up your nose and throw up can come out your nose.
But like down into your lungs and stomach, it's the same, right?
No.
And the lungs just block it off.
Like right here.
But if you open your airway, it can still get into your lungs.
Yeah, it still can get into your lungs, but it's like,
I need to look it up.
God didn't fuck
that. What is that tube called? Not your larynx.
Your trachea.
Larynx?
Is it trachea?
Trachea. Your windpipe.
Yeah, your windpipe. And that's why you'll be like, I went down the wrong pipe. Everyone's dead. Like, went down the wrong pipe.
Yeah, literally though.
Everyone's white dad.
All right, we have a meeting. TTYL.
TTYL. Well, Morgan, thank you for that.
Yeah, what do you have for us today?
Okay.
Hello.
What do you have for us today? Let me get it pulled up.
Thanks.
Okay.
We'll wait here.
One moment. I don't know where my docs went.
Sorry, guys. We had a meeting with Ashley in the middle of that. Hey, Ashley.
Okay. So the case I have for you guys today is from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And I do want to give you guys a trigger warning for DV and a few details of the crime scene that are a bit gruesome, but it's not going to be in super great detail. So in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, on Friday, February 20th, 2009, at 7 a.m., 911 dispatchers received a call from Greg Davis, and he was reporting that his wife, 34-year-old Chiquita Tate, a very well-known rising defense attorney, had worked late the night before, but when he woke up, he found that she had not returned home from the office.
Oh, no.
And he started calling her. After countless failed attempts to get into contact with Chiquita, Greg drove to her office, which is where he was calling from, because he could not get in the doors. They were locked and he was very, very worried. Officers were dispatched, but while waiting for them to arrive, Greg was actually able to flag down a passing officer who was able to get into the building. He told Greg to wait outside as he went in to investigate. The officer entered the State National Life building and made his way to the third floor using the elevator to Chiquita's office. But the scene that he walked into was not at all what he thought he was going to find. There was blood everywhere.
Oh my God.
From the floors to up the walls. And 34-year-old Chiquita was found lying on the floor of her office, dead. It was apparent that she had been brutally attacked. She had over 40 injuries to her body and face, with very apparent self-defense injuries, such as her pinky fingernail was broken, but also in her hand, they later found a few strands of hair.
Okay, that's always a good
That's
sign.
That's a great sign.
Especially with the nail she dug, she scratched.
Exactly. The officer immediately shut down the office building and called in for major backup. Outside of the building, Greg was frantically trying to break past the other officers who had arrived from the 911 dispatcher who had gotten the radio from the officer that went inside. And he was trying to get inside to check on his wife.
Right.
So he's like trying to break through them. He's hyperventilating. He's frantic.
At this point, he doesn't know.
He doesn't know anything, but they know it. He knows it's not good.
Yeah.
At the same exact time that Greg is learning what's going on and trying to get past the officers, Chiquita's family is arriving because they had gotten calls from Greg that whole morning, like something's not right. She's at her, like, I don't know what's going on. And I guess he might have updated them in the time between when the officer first arrived and he found out that it wasn't good, because they were pulling up fast and running out and just questioning the police about like what exactly is going on. Right. What did you
Someone
find?
Someone give us answers.
They knew that she was gone, but they didn't know the circumstances. And they were begging police to give them information about what happened. But that's all that police could tell them, was that she was gone. Because meanwhile, inside the building, the investigators are trying to figure that out. What did happen in here? They found it odd that the blood was contained to only Chiquita's office and the sink of the nearby kitchen. Other than that, there was no blood or evidence of a struggle in the lobby of the building, in the lobby that of the floor that her office was on, or in the elevators.
That's weird.
At first, they believed that this could have been a robbery gone wrong because Chiquita's purse had been dumped on the floor and her wallet was missing. However, they then realized that she was still wearing all of her jewelry, her wedding band, her engagement ring, and diamond earrings.
So unless they were looking for something specific,
exactly.
That doesn't seem like a robbery.
And not to mention, in like top drawer of her, very accessible drawer of her desk, there was $75 cash.
Okay, yeah, they would have taken that.
Exactly. Investigators needed to know more about Chiquita's night to help them piece together a timeline of this crime. Once Greg was able to speak with them after being able to calm down and get to a place where he realized, like, I'm going to have to literally give them everything I could think of to help them solve my wife's murder, he was able to tell them that he had gone to her office to have dinner with her because she wasn't going to be home till late and she didn't have any food. So he takes her dinner. They eat together until a client of hers stopped by at approximately 7 p.m. All the client had to do was drop off that $75 cash that she owed Chiquita. So she asked if Greg would go outside and meet this person at their car, which he did. But because Greg forgot to grab her like key fob that would let him back in into the building, he placed a book in the doorway to keep it open so that way he could re-enter after collecting the money from the client. He went back inside with the money, took it to Chiquita. She put it in her desk and they hung out for another hour or so. They said their goodnights and he left his wife to go home at approximately 8:30 p.m. Greg went home, he fell asleep on the couch and woke up to find that his wife had not come home from that night, which takes us back to the very beginning of this. Investigators then reached out to the client who had dropped off that $75 cash, and she confirmed the timeline of the story and they cleared her. In addition to her, they also confirmed that Greg did place the book in the doorway from the accounts of two other attorneys that were leaving work for the day from that building. But they also confirmed that Greg did not remove the book from the doorway after returning inside. He had forgotten about it and left it there. Therefore, the door was left propped open after he left to go home. Now that investigators had established a point of entry that someone could get into the building, because there had been no...
Without setting any alarms.
Exactly.
Or like,
and there was no like sign of a forced entry, and they checked the fob logs from this timeline and no one had entered the building with their like key card from 5:30 p.m. until 10:30 p.m. or 10:30 a.m. the next morning.
Okay.
So a long period of time.
So that was their entry point then.
Exactly. Unless they were already in there. Now that investigators had established that point of entry into the building, their suspect pool got a lot larger. Because before, only someone with a key would have been able to enter that building and it would have been registered in this key log. And that person would have had to attack Chiquita. Therefore, they needed to establish any potential enemies that she had to determine what motive someone would have had to target her and brutally murder her in this way. Through interviews with Chiquita's assistant and her records, investigators discovered that just 3 weeks prior to her death, she began working on an extremely high-profile murder case, which was set to go to court the following Monday after she was murdered. The defendants that she would be representing in this case were two brothers that were well known in the area for dealing drugs and murdering whoever would testify against them in court.
Okay.
And their names were Denico and Darius Duhart.
I mean, just like, what are the odds, though, that a door would be propped open for them? Yeah, that's...
Yeah.
Okay.
The Duhart brothers were on trial for the murder of Jason Formey, who was murdered and burned just days before he was set to testify against him in court. Despite the fact that it would not make a lot of sense for the Duhart brothers to target Chiquita, seeing as she was literally representing them in court, investigators just wanted to be sure that they saw this lead through. So they were able to confirm that both of the brothers were being held in jail at the time of her murder, ruling them out, essentially taking investigators back to square one. But just when they closed out this lead, another one came in. And this time it came from within the police department. The night of Chiquita's death at 10:30 p.m., a woman called in to report a wallet that she found on the side of Gardier Lane. The woman recognized this wallet and the woman it belonged to as Chiquita. She did not know Chiquita personally, but she had been a speaker at the woman's son's school to talk about law.
This, like a career girl.
Like a career day situation. Like, again, she didn't know Chiquita personally. And obviously, she had no idea that she had been murdered. No one did at this point in time. This was 10:30 on the 19th. She was discovered on the 20th. And this is a huge deal for three reasons. Number one, the wallet was the only thing that investigators could determine that had been stolen, meaning it could potentially have DNA or fingerprints that would lead police to her attacker, making this and the hair found in her hand two viable pieces of forensic evidence that were sent off to be tested. Number two, it establishes a timeline of Chiquita's murder. There is a 2-hour time gap between the time that Greg, her husband, left her office at 8:30 p.m. and when the woman found the wallet at 10:30 p.m. So her murder would have had to have taken place between 8:30 and 10:30 p.m. And number three, Gardier Lane was in a very, very, very bad area in Baton Rouge. It is known for incredibly high crime rates and homicide rates. But what is incredibly odd about this wallet, though, was that the fact that all of Chiquita's credit cards and debit cards and ID, everything was still inside.
So nothing from the
wallet
was
taken. So now
identifying her.
Yes. So literally nothing was taken from her at all other than just throwing it out the window. So now this is definitely not a robbery.
Right. This was attacked, planned.
A planned attack. Within a few days of sending the hair samples to the crime lab, with the wallet being sent in shortly after, investigators got another call. The testing found that the hairs were artificial, meaning that they came from a wig or extensions of some sort, a hairpiece. This was interesting, as originally investigators believed that Chiquita's attacker would have had to have been a male to overpower her in the way that the crime scene suggests she was. But this discovery changed that, forcing investigators to have to consider women that could be capable of overpowering Chiquita in the way that she was. Investigators now had so many leads. I mean, think about this. This is like 50 different leads.
Right.
And no direction to go with any of them.
No viable suspects at this point.
None.
Just leads.
Just leads. And they're all good leads, but there's just no way to connect all of them.
Right.
So they needed to set up a tip line. They needed help from the public. Within days, hundreds of leads and tips flooded in. One being from a woman called Amber, who reported that she heard another woman named Sherilyn bragging about being involved in the murder. The reason Amber felt that this was a viable lead was because Sherilyn was a client of Chiquita's. Amber claimed that the two of them were actually romantically in a relationship.
Sherilyn and Chiquita.
And Chiquita. Following this tip, investigators took a look into Sherilyn. So they were able to locate her at a house that she shared with her girlfriend Gladys. Separately, investigators questioned the couple about their connections to Chiquita and their alibis for the night of February 19th. Both confirmed that they had met her and they knew her because she represented them in an adoption, in the adoption of their child. Their alibis checked out and they both denied any romantic relationships with Chiquita. And they had no artificial hair pieces or wigs or extensions in their home at all when it was searched. Police then asked Gladys and Sherilyn if they knew an Amber. Were they hanging out?
Damn, that's kind of shitty of the police, though, because what if it, you know, what if they got rid of the hair and...
Well, because you know that they definitely, like, for police to ask that, then they...
They suspected something.
They suspected that something was up.
Okay.
So they were like, we don't know an Amber. We haven't done anything. We've been at home.
Yeah.
I don't work with an Amber.
So that's a red flag for Miss Amber.
Right. Leading investigators to believe that Amber had intentionally reported this false lead as an attempt to throw off the investigation. So they're like, we're going to fucking find Amber. They trace her callback and it's connected to a woman in Grand Prairie, Texas, named Cassandra Landry. A few investigators were sent to Texas, including lead detective Elvin Howard, who took the report from Amber, was on that phone call with Amber, where they located Cassandra and they questioned her about this call. She confirmed that, yes, she was the owner of that phone number. And yes, she had the phone that day. However, she was like, I never called you guys and I
don't know anything about
this case. Why would I call myself Amber? I don't even know who this is, right? But Cassandra did know an Amber. It was her daughter's best friend.
Oh my God.
So investigators then brought in Cassandra's daughter, Serena, to question her. Immediately, when she started talking, Detective Howard recognized Serena's voice as Amber's. He just straight up told her, like, well, I know you're Amber because you sound just like her. Here's the audio clip.
Oh my God. How old was Serena?
I'm not really sure. It doesn't say anywhere. So Serena quickly admits, like, yes, I did make the call into the tip line. I used a fake name. She admitted that she had lied about Chiquita being in a relationship with Sherilyn. But when asked how she knew this case or like why the fuck she wanted to get involved, Serena said it's because Serena is Greg Davis's sister, like half sister.
So Chiquita's sister-in-law.
Yes.
Okay. Pause. I'm so confused.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Don't pause.
Exactly how you're feeling is, I'm sure, exactly how investigators felt.
Oh, for sure. They're like, wait, what the fuck?
They went to Texas to go get answers to some of these damn questions. And they come back and they're like,
more questions.
We have more questions. Why would Greg's sister call in this fake tip, lie about Chiquita being in this fake relationship with Sherilyn, and then hide her identity?
Right.
It's just so weird. The only way that they could get to the bottom of this was by taking a closer look at Greg. Like, why would Greg's sister feel the need to call in?
Right.
Very quickly, investigators discovered that Greg Davis had a long history of domestic violence. They did a record search of 911 calls made from the couple's home, where they discovered that in the past 2 months, multiple domestic violence reports were made from Chiquita. According to Oxygen's reportings, in one of these reports, Chiquita told the dispatcher, quote, he grabbed my finger and then I took the ring. I threw it at him. And then he choked me and I couldn't move, end quote. After questioning some people close to Chiquita about this, they confirmed that he had been very violent towards her and other people in the past. Investigators found that just before her death, Chiquita had actually signed a lease for an apartment on her own, but had not moved out of the house with Greg yet. her sister Danita told police that the same day her sister Chiquita was murdered, they were on the phone. And on this call, Chiquita told Danita that she could not stay married to Greg any longer and she was leaving. They set up another interview with Greg where they questioned him. And this time they focused on his past and all of these allegations from friends and family members of Chiquita. Greg was very quick to deny any and all abuse allegations towards Chiquita and maintained his original story. But this time he added some new details. Greg told investigators that the night Chiquita was murdered, someone at 3:40 a.m. in the early morning hours of February 20th had come up to his bedroom window and shot through the window using a 10 millimeter gun 5 times. And if Greg wouldn't have fallen asleep on the sofa and instead fallen asleep in his bed, he would have been killed. It like ate up the mattress. But investigators were like,
you didn't want to tell us that till now?
Why would you not tell us that? So investigators decided to pull all of his phone records and trace his signals on the night that his wife was murdered, which is how they made a groundbreaking discovery. According to Greg's phone records and the cell phone towers, Greg was not telling the truth about where he was the night his wife was murdered. Instead, they found that after leaving Chiquita's office, he went to a location off of Gardier Lane before driving home.
With where the wallet was.
Where the wallet was found. When they confronted him about this, Greg admitted that, yes, I had gone to Gardier Lane prior to going home. But the reason why he lied about it was not because his wife was murdered and that's where her wallet was found. It was because he was illegally picking up steroids from his dealer that lived there. AKA, he just admitted that he was in the location that his wife's wallet was found after her murder in the time frame in which it would have needed to have been dumped there. And he verbalized it, admitted to being there. Police promptly obtained search warrants for Greg and Chiquita's home and Greg's car. In the home, investigators found multiple wigs and hair pieces. They sent them all off to the lab for testing and to be compared with the sample that was found in Chiquita's hand. Also in the home, they found small drops of blood in various locations, including some on a Clorox bottle. Next, in the car, police found a pair of safety glasses that had blood on them, and they sent them for testing as well. A few days later, the results came back. The hairs that were found in Chiquita's hand were an exact match to one of the wigs found in the home, and the blood on the safety glasses was a mixture of both Chiquita's blood and Greg's. Greg was then arrested for the murder of his wife, Chiquita Tate. The trial took place 2 years later.
Why did he have a wig on?
I don't think he actually had the wig on. Investigators believe that he chopped it and took it and put it in her hand to frame a woman.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that was a big part of the trial. Another part that was a huge piece in this trial was like what his motive would have been. Investigators were like, that you didn't want her to leave,
right?
Because she's a fucking lawyer,
right? And she's a victim of domestic violence.
Exactly. After this trial takes place, and there's really like not a lot of information about the dates and how long this trial was. Like, I looked at 50 different sources and it didn't give me the date that he was arrested, didn't give me the date that the trial started, didn't give me the date that he was sentenced, nothing.
I don't, it's a person of color and they're under,
they're not being reported on. Exactly.
Yep. The media is blocking that.
Yep. And just after 3 hours of deliberation, the jury found Greg Davis guilty of second degree murder or manslaughter. I think they originally went in with second degree murder because it wasn't premeditated.
Really though?
I think it was,
like,
to an extent.
They're saying that it was a domestic violence
situation that escalated. And I think he had a plea deal that if he pled guilty, he would possibly get manslaughter. If it was manslaughter or second degree murder, I'm not too positive, which I think if it's a domestic violence situation that escalated, it should be second degree murder, especially with how brutal her murder was.
For sure.
I mean, there, the officer that discovered her said that it was the most brutal crime scene that he's ever seen from Baton Rouge.
Yeah, I agree with you. Do you circle back to Serena at all?
He was sentenced to 40 years in prison, and that's it.
Do you think Serena called as Amber, knowing that the police would track her and she'd be like, I'm Greg's sister, and they would reopen, look at him? Or do you think Greg put her up to it and was like, throw the police off the guard for me?
I feel like she called and did that.
On her own doing, like just to point towards him.
No. Like, I think that it was him. To protect him. Because why would she involve herself?
Right.
You know?
But I also feel like if she never said, like, I'm Greg's sister,
then they never would have put that together.
Yeah.
I'm not really sure. But what I do know is that I want to say like a few months prior to this, in November of 2008, so just a few months prior, there were a lot of insurance policies changing and being added and taken away between Greg and Chiquita. Like they were doing something mm-hmm. and they don't really know who was doing it from what I read in the court document. And then also there was a loan that Greg had taken out that he had gotten to bail out his brother who was in prison for murder. When
a bailout on murder yeah. charge?
Okay. I don't know. I don't know what the details are on that.
What the fuck?
I don't know what the details are on that. But he had taken out a loan to, maybe it was to pay the legal fees for his brother. He had taken out a loan to pay for the legal fees for his brother who was on trial for murder. And he had defaulted on that loan. Like that happened around the same time that Chiquita was about to leave. So they said like the motive was is you were going to lose a lot of your money because mm-hmm. she made more money.
Right.
You were freaking out that she was going to leave you. You're freaking out that she was going to get you arrested because you were abusing her and you killed her. She said something to you when you came up to her office. She told you that she was moving out.
I'm just a little pissed off because I feel like his charges don't equate to any sort of justice for
me either
at all.
I mean, for her to be a criminal defense attorney.
Like they just that. Court hearing and the judicial system did not do her justice.
No,
I'm sorry,
at all. And she literally was a part of the thing about one fucking of our Murdoch. Own. You know, literally think about Murdoch and all this shit that's going on.
Right.
Like all we normally see is lawyers in the justice system protecting themselves.
Right.
So why not protect her?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, she was literally brutally murdered in her office because she was working late with her at the hands of her abusive husband.
Mm hmm.
Who made this whole scene.
This whole scene, whole scenario.
And like, you know, I found it weird when I first listened to this case. I was like, why would the officer tell him to go in without Greg?
Yeah, that's true.
Why would the officer go? Like if Logan was looking for me and if I was looking for Logan or if I was looking for you and I flagged
right
down
behind that damn tail.
Oh my God, I'm walking the fucking, I don't give a shit.
Yeah.
I'm like, I just wanted to come check on you.
Stop me? I'm coming in.
Yeah. Like
I called you to
grab my
in
foot
here.
In the door before you turn around. Like, yeah. Are you kidding? And then also something that was never like cleared up is like where this book went. When did the book get removed?
And also where is the blood trail from in the business or the,
it was, he cleaned himself off in that sink, which was the only other place that blood was found.
In the building, mm-hmm. office building.
Yes.
Damn, dude. Such a shitty case.
Such a fucked up case.
Fuck that guy.
Yeah.
And like, I feel like Chiquita had just gotten to this point of like the confidence and the ability mm-hmm. to leave her abuser.
Well, that's what a lot of people
said. And there's
said.
Just no protection against women. Like, even if she would have went and filed some sort of, what is it called?
Like a report against him for it.
Some sort of report or order of protection. Mm-hmm. It was like, I'm about to leave my husband, but he's an abuser. I'm scared for my life if he finds out. Da da da. Like, they don't even have that in place most of the time. You know what I mean?
I bet a lot of the reason why is because she's a defense attorney.
Right.
And so if she were to file something like that.
Probably ruin her career.
I mean, it's really hard.
So fucked up.
I mean, think about how hard it must be to be a woman in a predominantly male field mm-hmm. and then on top of that to be a black woman
mm-hmm.
in that, like, that's, you have to fight for your fucking life out there.
Yeah, fuck, dude.
I know. And so she probably felt like if she did that, she would not be able to continue on. It'll be used against her at some point.
Yeah.
You know what I think it comes down to at the end of the day is that this just proves even more so that there is not enough protection for victims of domestic violence.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And especially victims of domestic violence that are in some way public figures because of how it can be used against them. There's not a better way for people to protect themselves without being worried about the repercussions mm-hmm. of it. And that's fucked up.
Oh, it needs to change.
That needs to change. Like, it doesn't need to be this. And you know, that's another thing is there are a lot of very in the public people who are victims and are currently in domestic violence situations and relationships, but yet they can't do anything about it because they're afraid of the way that people...
They'll spin it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
It's such a fucked up situation.
Yeah. Fuck.
So...
Well, thanks for covering that. I think that was... I mean, it was a hard case to hear, but it's an important topic to discuss on.
Right.
Sure.
And we haven't talked about domestic violence in a really long time.
Our last creepy account, or yeah. Not our last one, but the last time we did was on a creepy account.
Yeah, And so I really wanted to bring that back up because of something that we experienced. So I wanted to make sure that we reminded you guys that we do offer in some way that we can help you. We used to have it as you could DM us this certain word. That's not going to work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think what would be best is probably sending something to our PO box.
Yeah.
just a letter being like, hey, this is for Creeps and Crimes podcast. And then in that letter, if you need to, like, capitalize in darkened letters.
And the good thing with writing something handwritten is that there's no electronic or digital copy that could be deleted by if your abuser got into your phone. They mm-hmm. couldn't get in there. They couldn't delete it before we saw it, or they couldn't mm-hmm. see that you even sent it. If you write a handwritten letter and you get it out the door before, you know, they come home, they'll never see it. So that's something to think about. We're not going to talk on it, but we have had something come through P.O. Box
before. Yeah. And it was like, really, the way that it came through, it was way easy for us to pull immediately. Mm-hmm. And we're going to start doing once a month. We're going to the P.O. Box. Well, let's just
probably more. Than
yeah,
that.
Probably more. But for sure once, because just in June, we didn't get to really get there a lot. And we really just went. We just did the haul on our Instagram story. Love.
Love.
Thank you so much, Hannah, for my Daddy Pascal handle and Sweet V's.
Oh, they're so bracelets. Cute.
I'm so obsessed.
They're so cute.
And we
cute.
Got so many little handwritten letters and invitations and all the things. We got to get back to you guys. We normally like to either DM you or send you something back or write something.
But while we love the gifts, of course, we love the gifts and the invitations and whatnot, please also use mm-hmm. that as a resource if you are ever in a situation where you may need aid or help. That is another option to get in touch with us.
And the fact that if you wrote it out for us and slipped it in on like a tiny little thing that explains what exactly is going on, what you need or what you want from us, you could act like you're sending us something and it'd be in the bottom. We read every single piece that comes out. If there is anything in there that you want to reach out to us about or let us know, just make sure that your return address is written in or on the card somewhere, so that way we can get you help and
in the area that you are. Love you guys.
Love you guys so much. And we will see you guys next week for 150.
See you next week. You guys aren't ready
for
this.
You're so not fucking ready for what we have for you. Love you. Bye.